The lie detector test, also known as the polygraph, is a great device for Hollywood justice. Like Wonder Woman's golden lasso, the polygraph promises to trap evildoers into helpless confessions. This fantasy couldn't be further from the truth. The polygraph works on the assumption that human beings undergo uncontrollable physiological changes when they lie. It measures and records responses in the subject's blood pressure, pulse, respiration, and skin conductivity while an interviewer asks a series of questions. The problem is that good liars can learn how to control their physiological responses. This has been documented in a number of famous espionage cases, including the case of double agent Aldrich Ames, who passed 2 polygraph tests while spying for the Soviet Union. When asked how he did it, he replied that he simply got a good night's sleep, cultivated a friendly rapport with the interviewer, and relaxed. Dawn Rummy is a key witness in the Cassandra Thomas murder case who claims she saw Mark Deal pull the trigger. She recently passed a lie detector test, but Ms. Rummy is also a teenaged substance abuser. This is a category of person known to be highly practiced in the art of deception. It is an outrage that the presiding judge would admit her lie detector test as evidence in a court of law. Notice this letter does not use a single conditional statement. Nevertheless, the assumption mentioned at the beginning of the second paragraph introduces the same logical leverage as a conditional statement. This suggests we begin our standard form as follows. 1. If the lie detector test is a reliable form of evidence, then all human beings undergo uncontrollable physiological changes when they lie. 2. But it is not the case that all human beings undergo uncontrollable physiological changes when they lie. 3. So the lie detector test is not a reliable form of evidence. We use so in step 3 because it is clearly not the end of the argument. The author's main conclusion is that the judge should not admit the lie detector test. We can get there by adding one more step. 4. If the lie detector test is not a reliable form of evidence, then it should not be admitted in the Cassandra Thomas murder case. 5. Therefore, the lie detector test should not be admitted in the Cassandra Thomas murder case. This 5-step standard form combines modus tollens and modus ponens. The sub-conclusion of the modus tollens argument at step 3 serves as the first premise of the modus ponens argument, affirming the antecedent of the conditional statement at step 4. Recall that the conditional statement does not have to come first. There may be other ways to represent the thought behind the editorial, but this is a legitimate interpretation, and it puts us in a good position to evaluate it. Sometimes newspapers print letters responding to editorials. We could write up a criticism of the above editorial as follows. Absurd standards. I read the editorial "Lie Detector Tests Lie" in astonishment. The author clearly does not understand the wisdom and the ancient principle, the exception proves the rule. The double agent Aldrich Ames is famous precisely because he is an extremely rare individual. The aspect of human physiology that controls emotional response is called the sympathetic nervous system. When the sympathetic nervous system functions correctly, it is completely involuntary. If Mr. Ames could control his blood pressure and pulse, then his sympathetic nervous system was probably malfunctioning. It is far more likely that Mr. Ames suffered from a physiological impairment than that he was well practiced in the art of deception. There are always anomalies. To say that in order to be reliable, the lie detector test has to work for all human beings is to say it has to be 100% accurate. And to say that it has to be 100% accurate is to say that any test admitted in a court of law has to be 100% accurate. But this is absurd. The best physicians use far less accurate tests to make life or death decisions about their patients. For example, DNA tests are used to detect cancer. The newest, most accurate one available is still only 95% accurate. Yet I guarantee you that doctors will be more than happy to use that test as evidence for making diagnoses that result in treatments and surgeries with irreversible consequences. Nothing in life is 100%. That's why the exception proves the rule. The author of this response is attacking premise one of the aforementioned standard form, according to which the lie detector test needs to work for all human beings in order to be a reliable form of evidence. Notice how the author undermines this claim in order to conclude the opposite. We can represent the argument in standard form as follows. To prove, the lie detector test does not need to work for all human beings in order to be admitted in a court of law. 1. Suppose the lie detector test needed to work for all human beings in order to be admitted in a court of law. 2. If the lie detector test needed to work for all human beings in order to be admitted in a court of law, then it must be 100% accurate to count as evidence. 3. If the lie detector test must be 100% accurate to count as evidence, then any test must be 100% accurate to count as evidence. If any test must be 100% accurate to count as evidence, then DNA tests must be 100% accurate to count as evidence. 5. So, if the lie detector test needed to work for all human beings in order to be admitted in a court of law, then DNA tests must be 100% accurate to count as evidence. 6. But it is absurd to suppose DNA tests must be 100% accurate to count as evidence, since they don't even need to be 95% accurate in order to diagnose cancer. 7. Therefore, the lie detector test does not need to work for all human beings in order to be admitted in a court of law. This argument combines two of the rules of inference we learned in this chapter. While the framework follows the reductio ad absurdum format, the conditional step in the middle is iterated 3 times in accordance with hypothetical syllogism. We could fabricate many more examples of many more combinations, for example, disjunctive syllogism and modus ponens. 1. Either P or Q. 2. Not Q. 3. So P. 4. If P, then R. 5. Therefore, R. Hypothetical syllogism with multiple iteration and modus ponens. 1. If P, then Q. 2. If Q, then R. 3. If R, then S. 4. If S, then T. 5. So, if P, then T. 6. P. 7. Therefore, T. Constructive dilemma with disjunctive syllogism and modus tollens. 1. Either P or Q. 2. If P, then R. 3. If Q, then S. 4. So, either R or S. 5. Not R. 6. So, S. 7. If T, then not S. 8. Therefore, not T. The possibilities are endless, but there is no need to get carried away. Most real arguments can be captured in just a few steps. Let's look at some examples for you to try. Exercises. Reconstruct the arguments in the following newspaper editorial excerpts, looking for instances of the rules of inference examined in this chapter. As with the exercises in the previous chapters, begin by drawing a blank standard form and then filling in the conclusion first. The conclusion is the main thing the author is trying to prove. Bear in mind that you will need to supply unmentioned steps and eliminate irrelevancies. Scribble a number of different possibilities on scrap paper until you capture the logic accurately. There is always more than one way to do it correctly. Identify the rule or rules of inference you use. Compare your answers to the key at the end of this book. Trade Pact Saps Manufacturing Jobs, by Sherrod Brown, USA Today. If NAFTA were really a free trade agreement, it would contain just a page or two on eliminating tariffs. Instead, NAFTA is an 824-page tome packed with rules to protect drug companies, banks and Wall Street investors. Safeguards for workers, the environment or food quality don't merit even a footnote. Act Now to Save the Salmon by Carl Pope, Los Angeles Times. As global warming bears down on our western rivers and watersheds, it threatens one of the great symbols of western abundance, wild salmon. With each passing year, their numbers have dropped precipitously. This decline is believed to be in part the result of warming temperatures in streams and rivers. Just last week, government fishery managers moved toward a ban on salmon fishing off the California and Oregon coasts because of the diminishing numbers of Chinook salmon. If we hope to save the salmon, we must do two things: stop the rise in greenhouse gases as quickly as we can, and secure our water's health against the warming that has begun and will continue. This is a river-by-river job, and each river matters. Bonus Baby from The Plain Dealer. J. Kenneth Blackwell's successor as Secretary of State, Democrat Jennifer Brunner, was the one who blew the whistle. But it's Blackwell's fellow Republican State Auditor Mary Taylor who is assessing the penalty. Taylor, following up on a request last year from the newly arrived Brunner for an audit of the Secretary of State's office, found that Blackwell paid $80,534 in going-away bonuses to the members of his staff. Taylor's audit also found that Blackwell left without leaving Brunner an inventory of property and assets of the office. That wasn't merely discourteous, it was illegal. Presumably, Brunner and her staff have located all of the staplers and three-hole punches by now, but such lapses certainly don't promote orderly transitions in government. If Blackwell's failure to provide his successor the most complete rundown of the administrative state of the office was an innocent oversight, it bespeaks a lack of seriousness. If it was done consciously, it bespeaks pettiness unworthy of a public servant in state office. Closing the Achievement Gap. Raul Bourbon and Susanna Zamorano, Pasadena Weekly. If we do nothing, statewide budget cuts will deepen the inequities that already exist among students in the Pasadena Unified School District. So we must do something. That's why several different community organizations are getting together Saturday at All Saints Church to host a community summit on what must be done. The aim is to involve not only schools administrators and elected officials in helping our kids, but also teachers, parents, and other concerned members of the community who can help offer real solutions. The Nature Editorial. Michael Egnor, The Discovery Institute, Evolution News and Views. The editors of Nature magazine assert that the emergence of the human mind without intelligent design is an unassailable fact. Perhaps the most remarkable thing about this claim, aside from the problems with their interpretation of the scientific evidence itself, is the admission by the editors that the question of intelligent design in biology can be adjudicated by the scientific method. If the evidence for or against intelligent design can be evaluated scientifically, as the editors at Nature firmly assert that it can, then intelligent design is a real scientific inference, albeit, according to the Nature editors, a mistaken one. And if they are asserting that intelligent design is mistaken from a non-scientific standpoint, then the editors are advancing an atheistic theology, as Brownback pointed out. The mainstay of the materialists' argument against intelligent design has been that it isn't science. Yet, as the Nature editors inadvertently demonstrate so clearly, the materialists' argument against intelligent design is self-refuting. They argue that intelligent design isn't science and that it's scientifically wrong. Yet, if intelligent design is scientifically wrong, if it is an unassailable fact that the human mind is the product of evolution, not intelligent design, then the design inference can be investigated, and they claim refuted, using the scientific method. then intelligent design is science. Either the conclusion that the editors reached is the result of a scientific analysis of the design inference, or the conclusion that the editors reached is the result of a non-scientific analysis of the design inference, which would be, as Senator Brownback observed, atheistic theology posing as science.